Brown here. This is the Alton Brown cast, and at the moment, we're recording from high above my garage in Marietta, Georgia, but we will soon be moving to New York City, and we're going to talk to Ted Allen today, one of my favorite people on Food Network, of course, the host of, well, I guess the most popular show on Food Network, which is Chopped. We're going to talk to him about everything that's going on in his world and about this crazy experience of being in the food TV business. All right, time to turn to that ancient piece of technology, the telephone, and deal with some of your call-in questions. Neil, where are you, Neil?
Well, I'm in Utah. I was in Atlanta yesterday, but I'm from North Carolina, Wilmington.
Well, it sounds like you can't stay put. What is your culinary conundrum?
All right, I love grilling, and I've tried to cook practically everything that you've ever grilled on the show. But I'm a propane. I'm lazy in that regard. I do gas from time, or excuse me, charcoal from time to time. But how do you keep a grill clean?
I'm going to fess up. I have a gas grill as well. And although it's not my preference, you know, on a Wednesday night when the kid's screaming for something to eat, you know, I'll fire that thing up. And I do that mostly because I want to drink my gin and tonic in peace. So I leave the kitchen, go outside, stand in the driveway and cook on a gas grill. And here's my protocol. First off, you're in order to keep a grill clean, you got to start with one that's clean. And the reason that you need to start with one that's clean is because the key to keeping a grill clean is high heat. So the first thing you got to do is make sure that your grill is in good repair, that all of the gas jets are working properly, and that you're getting a good clean burn. When's the last time it was professionally cleaned or you had the jets cleaned, the actual, you know, jet array underneath?
The jets never, but at the beginning of each season, I disassemble the whole thing and completely scrub it down.
Okay.
And, you know, all the nooks and crannies of it.
Right.
That obviously helps a lot.
First off, I replace my jet array once every 2 years, no matter what. I just do it because carbon builds up in there, moisture builds up in there, because moisture is a byproduct of burning that natural gas. So I just do it. Then here's what I do. Every time I grill, when I'm done grilling, you know what I want to, you know what I do? No, I do nothing. I turn it off and forget about it, okay? I don't clean the grates. You know why? Because I'm done cooking. I want to go eat now. So I'm not going to, like, stand around and clean the freaking grill. And here's what's brilliant about that, is that 9 times out of 10, the crap that I leave on the grill protects it from rust and stuff, because it's greasy and stuff. So I just leave it. I don't care. I leave it. And then what I do is that the next time I crank it up early, okay? And I crank it up all the stinking way. With the lid closed, I will blast it for like 15 to 20 minutes. And then I just go in with, I like these pads, these things called Gorilla pads, which is like a super duper heavy steel wool that's kind of clamped onto a handle. And I will scrape down the grill grates with that. And then that's all I do. I'll give them a slight lube with oil right before I cook on them. Right before. I'll take an old towel, barely dip it in some oil, and really quickly grab it with tongs and very quickly give the grill grates a swipe before I put the food down. And I swear that's all I do for the year. But I make sure that every time I crank that grill up, I can leave that lid closed long enough to blast all that junk away. We'll talk to you again soon. Enjoy your trip. This is Matthew. Matthew, where are you located?
Lake Tahoe, Nevada. I recently saw your episode on beer making, and I recently got a kit also, so I'm going to go in depth over that episode once again and see how that turns out.
You know, that was one of my favorite episodes, but a lot of beer home brewers have absolutely jumped all in my business about that show, because you should have done this and you should have done that and you didn't do that and you broke this rule. And then other people say, oh no, it's fine. So about that, you know, about the beer making, all I can say is, I used the procedure from the show and I made some pretty gosh darn good beer. That's not the end all be all to home brewing. It's the best I could do in half an hour, which actually translates to 21 and a half minutes of real TV time. So the best thing you can do, or the best thing I think that show could do for you, is send you to the beer maker supply shop in your vicinity and get you asking more questions. So, don't, if you're going to the trouble of really getting yourself set up in a home brew rig, don't just use my show. There's a lot of other more detailed stuff that I would recommend you kind of get into. That the show will get you to the beer, but if you really want to get a home brewing, do more research. Do real due diligence on that. Okay?
All right. That sounds very good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much. All right. Let's root around inside our internet mailbag for a good question. Hey, Alton, this comes from Glenn Levitt. That's cute. Alton, has there ever been a fusion of foods that actually works for you? I assume you mean of cuisines like, you know, Cuban Icelandic or Tex Thai. No, the answer is no. I can't think of one that actually works for me. All right, looking down through the old Twitter feed here. Here's somebody, Paul Doherty asks me, I'm in the market for a new food processor and would greatly value your recommendation. I'm not big on, well, let's just say that I don't like calling out brands because then everybody thinks that I'm on the take. But I got to tell you, there is no, I'll only tell, let's put it this way. I'm going to back up. I will tell you what is in my kitchen, okay? And then we're just going to leave it at that. I own the classic Cuisinart 11, I think it's called, the classic 11. It has, instead of a bunch of touch buttons, soft buttons on the front, it just has the big paddles, a pulse paddle and an on and off paddle. That's it. If you can find one of those, the classic 11, I'm pretty sure is what it's called, I would go with that. I think it's a fine machine. It's heavy as heck, and you want that. If a food processor is light, it's trash. There's just no way around it, you know, because motors, good motors, weigh a lot, and you want a really good motor. You also want a work bowl that functions properly and isn't overly complicated. So that's my take on that. Hi, welcome to the Alton Browncast. We're recording this week in New York City, remotely, so that we can have access to some fine folks, including the gentleman sitting with me right now, Ted Allen, who if you're a Food Network fan, you certainly know him as the host of Chopped, and we'll often hear his voice say things like, Baby Ruth, pound of hamburger, mothball...
And Eye of Newt.
And Eye of Newt. And you guys really should do like a Shakespeare Chopped, where it's all stuff.
We actually
Wool of bat, tongue of dog.
We actually do it all the time, although it's usually even grosser and more obscene ingredients than Eye of Newt. All TV shows should have blooper reels. Ours would be broadcast very late at night.
So worst basket. What ingredients did you, when you were reading them out, thought, no, in the English language, these words have never been combined before, and no one person has spoken these things, nor should they.
You know, people ask me all the time, what's the worst basket for you? Or what? In fact, Food Network itself just asked me that question.
I bet they did.
I don't remember. I can't remember. We do this long run. If we shoot 39 episodes, that's 654 baskets. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of baskets. Mm-hmm. I can remember individual ingredients. I don't like durian, which is a large...
Stinks!
It's a big, spiky...
Stink bomb.
Big, spiky, it's a melon about the size of a basketball that's filled with some gooey stuff that smells, most people describe it as the smell of rotting meat.
With some added sulfur.
Rotting meat plus farts. It is prized in many Asian cultures.
Although not allowed on the trains.
Although not allowed on the subway. And yes, as you know.
In Singapore,
In Singapore and in some other countries, they have, you know, those signs on the New York subway that says no smoking, spitting, or radio playing. Right. Then they have the red circle with the slash through it. They literally have that.
For durian
in many Asian countries. We had a basket ingredient once that was the whole head of a pig that had been skinned. And that's just kind of hard to look at. I can look at it, but my mom didn't like that much. All the wacky ingredients I know are what get people really excited. For me, honestly, if I could have my way, we'd give these chefs something delicious to cook.
Yeah, and see if they could actually cook it. Yeah.
And make it more about their abilities than confronting them with horrifying things like chicken feet and rattlesnakes. Which, right. By the way, a rattlesnake is not worth eating at all, and they cost about $100.
That's expensive.
And it's full of bones, and you have to peel the
And it tastes like frog.
Exactly.
Which tastes like chicken.
Which tastes like alligator. Yeah. Which tastes like nothing.
By the way, alligator reminds me. People ask me, I can't remember. When people ask me, what's the hardest secret ingredient in Kitchen Stadium or whatever? And I can't. I'm like you. By the end of the run, I can't remember any of them.
I can't remember who was there.
So I make up this answer, which is, well, it was battle crocodile. And they're like,
which is an endangered
species.
Why
did you? Well, actually, I've changed it recently to battle alligator. And they're like, I didn't see that one. And I say, we couldn't air it.
That way I never actually have to have an answer.
Why didn't I come to you years ago for this knowledge?
This
we
should talk.
You and I have a particular kinship at Food Network. And we have some very definite things in common, and we've always enjoyed performing together. You've got this knowledge base that I really should have tapped a long time ago, because I'm always just honest. I say, like, I can't remember a single basket. I couldn't tell you one. I could get close. I could give plausible baskets, things that could have been and probably were baskets. And we've done so many episodes now that I'd be...
Nobody's going to call you out.
Exactly. Oh, you know, giving a fake answer is brilliant.
Oh, yeah, because nobody's going to call you on it. No one will do it. Trust me. Give this a try. Just make one up and stick with it.
Yeah,
nobody will give you a hard time.
Well, the endangered species basket was really my favorite.
The Komodo dragon.
The Komodo dragon.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, Indiana.
So you grew up in, you weren't a city kid, so to speak, at all.
Suburbia Plaza.
So you probably remember being sent out on summer days. Here's your bicycle. Go away.
Yeah.
And come back at dinner time, or come by at lunch and get a sandwich.
It was actually pretty idyllic. We had my mom's house is on a wooded lot with a creek behind it. We could go fishing.
We had the creek.
We had a creek.
Creeks are good. I was a good 15-minute walk from the creek, but I also grew up near creeks. Creeks are, boys, I think, should have creeks. They
boys
teach you
creeks.
A great deal about life. Because if you get on that rock or you dive into this, you're going to be very deeply injured, and you learn all kinds of things.
Yeah, you can't really dive in our creek. It's the deepest part of it is probably 6 feet deep. But you can take your BB gun and shoot water spiders and catch frogs. And
do you remember your BB gun?
I do. I remember it well.
Do you still have it?
It's at the house. It was a Daisy.
Of course it was.
Which I thought was unfortunate. I wanted the other kind.
What other kind was there when we were kids?
There was... Daisy is not a very rugged name for a gun.
No.
You don't see, you know, Ruger selling anything called a flower.
That's true. And Ruger, on the other hand, is an awesome name.
It's an awesome name. Crossman was the one I wanted.
And they did... Well, and they made pellet guns. They made serious pellet guns as well. I had a single-shot Crossman pellet gun, which is completely... impractical to use because you're
a
loading
single shot.
Well, you literally loaded a pellet at a time.
They're the size of a pea. They're smaller than a pea.
Yeah, I couldn't even see them now, much less load one.
Yeah.
So I do have a question for you, because I was thinking about this the other day. I gave a speech down in Orlando, and the topic that they wanted me to talk about was the effect of food programs on culture. And I've been saturated with research and things that I've been reading, and the truth is nobody knows anything. Do you have any... Do you think about this at all, either about how this happened, why it happened, or our effect in general on this? And I'd love to know what you think, because you've worked in a bunch of segments of this. You're an author, but you came to television not through Food Network. You came here. You were in a very popular show. I mean, the Queer Eye thing was a huge hit, made you a famous guy. Don't know if it made you a rich guy, but it made you a famous guy.
I was a journalist before, so I had nowhere to go but up.
You're already at the bottom, so yeah. any daily eating looked pretty good. What were you doing, by the way, because I want to get to the bigger subject, what were you doing right before
Queer Eye? Right before Queer Eye happened, I had a contract to write for Esquire,
right,
which was an enviable, wonderful thing to have. I was supposedly required to produce X number of stories per year, but in reality, I spent a lot of time gardening and padding around the house and roasting things.
Well, how many pieces a year did you actually deliver? Do you remember? I mean, what was it?
Well, and I'm not a lazy person at all.
Hey, dude, I'm not saying...
But
you're the one that said padding around the house and gardening.
But, well, gardening is work.
It
you
is.
Know, it just does, it's just not
Paying
very...
work.
It's really not all that useful. And no, it doesn't. It's actually expensive, and I tend to kill plants.
I kill things that I touch.
I'm actually brewing compost tea in my backyard right now. I try
Which
to
is smart.
It's fun too. It's bubbles. You buy an aquarium bubbler and you put it in a 5 gallon bucket, put compost in there and water and a little molasses to feed the microorganisms, and it bubbles merrily for several days and smells sweet. And I'm going to put that on my tomatoes.
You're basically making beer.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I suppose I am. And now that I think about it, beer might be also a nice thing to feed the microorganism. You know, compost itself is great,
yes,
but when you make the tea, you're actually giving sugar to these microorganisms and allowing them to reproduce and go. So it turns into this incredibly powerful pest repellent and food for your plants. And for me, tomatoes are the issue here. I will grow good tomatoes this year, I swear.
Did you last year?
No, I had terrible blossom end rot. And I've treated the soil now with lime, garden lime, which is supposed to help with that. And mm-hmm. I've studied mm-hmm. the right application of organic fertilizer. And hopefully I'll do better this year.
I'd asked about padding around the house and working in the garden when you were supposed to be delivering large chunks of word material.
Of stories.
And so they decided, well, since you're just going to pad around the house, we're gonna go do this TV show instead? I mean,
I heard about the auditions for Queer Eye from a friend here, and I thought, well, I was living in Chicago writing for Esquire, mm-hmm. which is a national magazine based in New York, and when you're a satellite correspondent, any FaceTime that you can get with your editor is beneficial.
Sure.
They're doing things. They don't know what you're up to. You don't know what they're up to. You don't know if someone's planning a palace coup or what.
And if they're in New York, they assume you're a hick anyway because you're not in New York.
Yes, that's true. They do assume that, and they in my case weren't far off. But so I thought, well, I'll go to the auditions for this ridiculous TV show, which I obviously won't get, and I'll spend $200 on a flight, and I'll crash on my friend's sofa, and I did that, and a lot of other people did that. 500 or 600 people auditioned for Queer Eye. I think I might have been the only one not from New York. I know now that Carson Kressley and I were the first two people that they cast. Perhaps because we sort of bookend one another a little mm-hmm. bit, we're slightly different in appearance and demeanor, and
slightly.
And I was recently thinking about. I had been asked if I could give a commencement address, and I was unable to do it because of scheduling. But I was thinking about what would I say to young people that would be of any value at all, because the hoax that passes for my career is a pretty strange bit of. It's not a linear path.
Meandering.
It's a meandering path, and I think most careers are like that anymore, and one needs to be prepared for that. If I could say anything useful to a graduating class, it might be something along the lines of, first of all, do what you love. Find something that you love, and try to make that your life and your career. You certainly did that when you decided to go to culinary school back in the day, and then created Good Eats and were able to combine your love of food and your love of goofiness and nerdiness and community theater and...
All of that stuff.
I realized at Chicago Magazine, which is where I worked before Esquire, that food was something I really, really loved. When I got the Queer Eye gig, I quickly figured out that I had the best category of the five. You know, there was fashion and grooming and something nebulous called culture. If you're making over a guy in terms of his appearance, you can give him a haircut, you can whiten his teeth, whatever, but it's limited. It's limiting. You can send him to the gym. You can give him a spray tan. I could do anything from teach you how to sous vide, a piece of pork belly, to talking about the different ranges of champagne, the styles of champagne, to how to cook a lobster. I mean, it was completely getting into other ethnic cuisines, utterly and completely limitless. So I was lucky enough to be able to work in TV, which also pays well, on a subject that I really love. So I would say, A, do what you love, but also. Nobody works at the same company for 25 years anymore and gets a gold watch. You need to keep your eyes open for weird opportunities that you might not have ever even dreamed of. I never planned to work in television. I've never been in a school play. I've at that point in my life, I'd never done any public speaking. I'd never been in front of a camera. And for some reason, it didn't even make me nervous being in front of a camera. I enjoyed it. I went for that opportunity because it sounded weird and funny. Also, the fact that I wasn't out of the closet to my entire extended family, all of which are conservative Southern folks. I wonder if there was something inside me that made me do that in part to kind of force myself to tell them and get it over with. And I have to say, if you have a deep, dark secret that you are having trouble revealing... Doing it on Bravo is very effective.
Yeah.
Really took care of that and just nipped that puppy right in the bud.
Yeah.
A lot of questions stopped getting asked.
Yep. No, not going to be any questions now.
So I guess I have had a lot of luck in my life, and I've had a lot of things turn out nicely that I really can't take credit for. But I've, as I speak to this graduating class, I would say be open. Try to recognize opportunities that might not be obvious. And then at the same time, also, you have to hustle. I mean, the only reason I got a job with Esquire was because I flew out here of my own accord. I arranged informational interviews with a couple of editors at prominent magazines. They foolishly agreed to see me. And then I had a face and a name and a direct phone line and began pestering them with story ideas.
I like this whole commencement thing because it makes you think. I gave the commencement maybe 3 years ago, a spring commencement at University of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
46,000 people.
Wow.
And it makes you evaluate everything you are, everything you think. Commencement, to be asked to do a commencement is a huge deal if you're going to take it seriously, because it makes you really think. Number one, what do I have to say? Number two, what do I have to say that's of any value whatsoever?
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself simply going over a list of things that I wish to gosh somebody had said to me at that point in my life. And, you know, and then I spoke from the heart about it. But a lot of it was about we get so stuck looking for the thing we think we want that we miss all the stuff we really ought to be doing.
That is true.
We have these notions of what we're going to do. And I made up a metaphor of looking, losing your keys in your apartment and looking for them with a telescope.
Ah.
Once you become so myopic in your focus on this thing that you think that you're supposed to be doing, you miss all the good stuff.
And by the way, it's incredibly hard because you have to take a step back from that point in the process. First of all, you have to know what you want. You have to figure out what you want.
But before you can try to getting out of college even knows that.
Exactly. And you make these decisions when you're 16 and 17 on what you're going to study. Knowing what you want is step one. And I was very fortunate to discover what I wanted pretty early, which was to write for magazines. And had an opportunity to do that for a while when magazines were fairly healthy. Magazines are less healthy now, and I have another opportunity to work in a different medium, thankfully. But for a kid
meaning
to know
television, which isn't doing so well either.
Yeah,
we're going to mention that.
Well, I'm just moving from one media to another. I'm destroying one media at
like a virus.
At
you're
a
just
time.
Moving through, and well, let me know where you're going next.
so you can avoid really it.
No, I want to catch a ride.
Knowing what you want. You have to know what you want before you can get it, before you can try to get it. And what I really wanted was to be the lead singer of Aerosmith, but fortunately...
Why Aerosmith?
I just say that because it sounds fun and because they have longevity. And because Dream On is really the perfect rock song.
It is.
It is.
I wonder how they feel having written that in, 1973 and never really topping it?
Yeah, I guess they did. Well, love
73. It. Patrick Belden, you would know this. What year? Dream On? I want 70...
1972.
72. Well,
holy smokes! Walk this way.
Actually, walk this way is a fine tune. And actually, love in an elevator is not so bad.
No, but it's not Dream On.
But it's no Dream On.
No, it's not Dream On. So anyway, so you get into TV and you're doing Queer Eye, and it was a phenomenally huge show. And yet, I dare say you never quite seemed. You didn't drink the Kool-Aid. I never felt like you drank the Kool-Aid. You always seemed to know you were on a good ride, and you had another trajectory in your head. And maybe that's because you did have the subject that was the one that actually had depth and interest to it. Because, you know, in the end, you know, you can only buy so many jackets and clean up an apartment. You started realizing that you could teach. I sensed that you actually changed during the experience and knew there was something else for you.
Well, I wish I could claim to have been that intentional about it all, but I did always think, and people always said when Queer Eye was happening, that I should end up on Food Network someday, and I thought, well, that'd be great, that'd be cool. When Queer Eye was at its peak was when we first met and when I had the first opportunity to judge on Iron Chef.
Right.
Bruce Seidel called.
Sure.
You were shooting the first season of Iron Chef in Los Angeles. For some reason, we were out there, and I got to do a guest gig on Iron Chef. It was thrilling. I was so psyched. And I guess, when Queer Eye ended, at that point, the network and I had become friends, and I was able to judge on Iron Chef and Top Chef at the same time,
which I don't know anybody else managed to pull that one off.
I guess they just thought, both sides just thought that, well, you're just a bit player. You're just a judge in these shows. You show up for a little while. You're not. I don't think either network would have allowed me to host anything. Mm. But that kept me on TV talking about food for a couple of years before a bigger opportunity came along.
And that was, what was that opportunity?
That was a show called Food Detectives, mm-hmm, on Food Network, which pulled me into the Food Network family and gave me the chance to host my own thing. It was a very hard show to do, but it got me in. And it was only when my friend Linda Lee created Chopped that I really had the chance to get into something that was going to reach a pretty good-sized audience and do a lot of episodes. And
did they pitch you on Chopped? Did they come to you? We want you to host this. Here's what it is.
Because
we're talking about by far the best made and probably most popular culinary competition that there is right now, I think.
That's very kind of you to say. Thank you.
No, it's true. The numbers prove it.
I can't take credit for that, but I think the people that make our show do a beautiful job, mm-hmm. from the casting to the set to the editing to the... I love our camera operators. We have something like 98% of our camera operators come back every season, mm-hmm. to do the show. They love doing the show. It's a fun gig. We've been doing pretty long runs, so they have some security.
Sure.
And for them, it's like a football game. It's just like the Iron Chef camera guys. They love chasing chefs around with knives and fire and whatnot. I was not a part of the original Chopped. There was a pilot made for Chopped that never aired. I have a copy of it, in which the concept was very different. Chopped now is a very simple, streamlined idea. We give you a basket of difficult ingredients. Can you cook them together or not? The original Chopped was set in a mansion. The host of the show was the butler of the mansion in a tuxedo. This was not me. Somebody else did this. The host would hold a chihuahua. The contestants would pull up in limousines. And each course, when somebody was chopped, their food was fed to the chihuahua.
Shut up.
And your reaction is similar.
Shut
your reaction, up. I think, is similar to the reaction that Food Network probably had as they screened this.
No, I freaking love it. I can see Eddie Izzard playing the butler.
Yeah.
And who's holding the chihuahua? I got to think that through. It's going to take me a couple of minutes.
I wish I could remember who did it.
You actually possess a tape of this?
I have it somewhere.
Oh, dude.
I shouldn't really admit that because people are going to want it.
No. Yeah, they're going to want it, and you should make it available.
And there's a guy, as you know,
ransom it.
There's a guy writing a book about, I don't know if it's about Food Network or if it's just about food television generally, but I made the mistake of confessing to him that I have this. And then I had to stop answering his emails because he wouldn't leave me alone. I'm not giving you this thing. So this wacky version of the initial version of Chopped arrives at the network, kind of lands with a thud. I think they thought, well, this is just too weird for us. I think Good Eats is about as weird as Food Network is ever going to get.
At the time.
Yeah, now I think there's some new weird. There's some fresh new weird on the horizon coming.
Mike could go repitch that tape that you have.
Yeah, exactly.
As the executive producer and get a deal tomorrow. I don't know.
That could be. But I think the network saw something in Chopped that they liked. They mm-hmm. liked, and they decided with Linda and Bob, and I'm not sure who all else was involved, but they decided to strip away all the goofiness and just do a very straightforward competition that really is about, for the most part, really is about food. Yes, they do talk about chefs' backstories, and they get into their characters, and maybe there's been an illness in their life or some other struggle, and they get into that stuff. But I do understand that what makes Chopped fun for a lot of people is seeing chefs struggle
sure.
with horrible things like
bicycle wheels. Yeah,
yeah, it's, exactly. And used cigars and chicken feet. And that is part of the fun.
Oh, it's mesmerizing. I watch it because I'm always, as a cook, thinking, oh, God, what would I do?
As are we. And, you know, that's...
What would I do with that?
If you think about it, I know that for you and me, the idea of tasting food and comparing one dish to another dish is really quite simple for us. And then trying to articulate what something tastes like in a way that people can understand through TV is something that you do very, 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 very well. And I think I do a decent job of it, too. I particularly try to communicate how food tastes in a way that anybody could understand.
Mm-hmm.
So that when one of our judges says, oh, I think chef is making a gastrique, I will jump in and say...
And that is
basically a sweet and sour sauce.
Yes. Reduced thing with a lot of vinegar in it. Yeah.
And in fact, I'm probably not even 100% accurate, but I'm close to helping an audience. You can be Mr. Smarty Pants, know-it-all, professing to the world how brilliant how deep your knowledge of food is, and sort of tighten the door, or you can open the door to people and invite them into the fun and make it easier for them to understand, and that I find that more satisfying.
Well, you make it an inclusive club instead of an exclusive club.
Yeah.
you know, which I think pulls people in when it would be very easy to lock them out.
So before I forget, because you you wanted to talk about the impact of food television on culture, I did want to know that. One of my favorite impacts that our show specifically has had, that Chopped has had, I did a book tour for my cookbook last year, and this woman brought a six-year-old boy up to the table and said, "I would like to thank you," not really meaning it, "for the fact that my six-year-old now asks me, 'Mom, did you taste this before you sent it out?'"
Oh.
As you know, kids love to watch these shows.
Adore them.
And I know the network has in the past, Food Network has tried to make programming designed for kids that didn't really work out. Kids want to watch Iron Chef. They want to watch Chopped. They want to watch...
They're already watching. They're already watching these shows.
In droves. And our network is a safe place for them. We don't do anything dirty.
Nope.
And we sneakily are educating kids about food. So one incredibly positive thing that Food Network does in culture, in American culture, is hook in children at a really young age, show them how food is cooked, get them inspired and excited about food,
yep,
and hopefully produce some kids who might want to eat something other than a chicken nugget.
Yep.
Which is, and not that we deserve any... kudos for that per se, where you and I are making shows because we like to do this and it's fun and it pays well. But I know we both believe in that very strongly, and that's a very, very beneficial effect. Now, one of the negative effects, I think, of food television on American culture is to set the expectations for young culinary students a little too high and make people want to be on TV rather than want to be at the stove.
Yeah.
They think you pay $100,000 to go to the CIA, the Culinary Institute of America.
Is that what it is now? Is it $100,000?
I think it's in that ballpark.
Yeah.
And what they may not, and they're doing it because they think they're going to be the next Alton Brown or the next Giada De Laurentiis, and they're probably not, and they're more likely going to be working the first 5 years of their lives for $10 an hour.
Yeah. No breaks and no benefits.
No breaks and no benefits. And if you're going to do that, you need to do it for the right reasons, which is you love being a chef. You really want to be a chef. That needs to be the goal. This other stuff might happen. But again, you're just like I'm unlikely to become the lead singer of Aerosmith. It's very hard to get a television show. And I think it's actually harder to get one on Food Network than it is on a lot of other networks.
My stock answer, because people ask me, and even kids, how can I get what you have? How can I get a show on Food Network? And my stock answer is, you can't. And
you can't.
One time, I had like a 14-year-old boy who gave me the correct comeback to that, which was, he looked at me and said, "Well, why not? You did." And I'm like, okay, there you go. That's the right stuff. If I can shut you down by saying you can't have it, you're already done. Because you're only going to be told no.
Or perhaps he could have said, "Yes, I can."
Yeah, same thing. That's basically what he was saying. If you did it, I can do it. Why? You know, sure, I know that I can do it. And that's the correct answer. You know, but most people are shut down immediately. You know, I say, "You can't." And they're like, "Oh, okay,
yeah.
I'll go do something else."
I know you and I get that question all the time. How do I get it?
How do I get what you
have? Sometime when you have a chance, can we chat? I need to find an agent, and I have this great idea for a Food Network show, and I've proposed shows to the network, and it's very, very hard to sell a show to Food Network.
Extremely.
I think because everybody thinks they have a show for Food Network. We all eat.
And so we all have ideas.
And we all have ideas. And as a consequence of that, Food Network has heard those ideas. It's hard. It's very hard.
The thing with kids, I just want to say, not too long ago, in a food court situation, where I'm not often in food courts, but I have a 13-year-old daughter, and 13-year-old girls apparently want to go to malls and they want to shop. And we were in a food court scenario, and a father and his son, who was about 8, were sitting a couple of tables away eating like these chicken wraps, and the boy looked up and said, "I don't know, Dad, I think it could use a little acidity."
Ah! And that was one that I used to also generally explain on Chopped. I would say, when you say it needs a little acidity, you mean you want a squeeze of lemon juice or a splash of vinegar.
A splash of vinegar to brighten the dish.
You want some tanginess.
Some tanginess.
In the dish.
Because acidity, I don't think that people automatically they don't have a taste point for that. You know, so you've got to say lemon, or you got to, you know, even a word like bright, I think, is better than acidity. But
I think you're right. We're at a point where so many people consume this programming that language is getting out there.
Does it make it difficult for old-fashioned hospitality, though? One of the things that I worry about is that all cooking is now a competition. It's all – and therefore all of us that are being served food are judges.
Yes.
You know, so it's like the old-fashioned dinner parties become a very difficult place now because, you know, Martha Stewart set everything up to where you had to do everything and be impressive. I knitted the doilies this afternoon. I spray painted the gravel. I made the water from scratch. And then now with things like Iron Chef America, it's like, okay, I'm not just feeding you. I've got to impress you. I must dazzle you with my pantry and this technique and this technique. And then you're all going to sit here and taste it and say, well, I think the bouillabaisse is a little off and you didn't, blah, 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 blah. Or have we put food into a place that it should not be?
I mean, we've all always been food critics, but now, unfortunately, we've been given the authority to, we're all talking about it.
And the vocabulary.
And the vocabulary, too. And, you know, a little knowledge being a very dangerous thing. And we're yelping about it, and we're yelping prematurely about it, and shutting down restaurants, you know, the day they open with negative
reviews.
With
bad yelps. It's mob mentality.
I mean, you know, obviously we're in a time of enormous information overload and people having access to platforms on the internet that they never had before. Tough time to be a chef. I mean, on the one hand, great time to be a chef. Wonderful time to be a food lover. But it's true, everyone's a critic now. How good that is, I'm not... Well, I mean, for more people to be propelled into the kitchen by this passion, I think is nothing but good, nothing but great.
But how often is that actually the case? I don't know.
I don't know for sure, but I know that when you have people like Mark Bittman and Michael Pollan writing columns extolling the profound importance of cooking.
Of home cooking. Home, yourself.
I mean, I'm not so sure it's a great thing that everybody in the world thinks they're a critic. But I do think it's great that once they get that knowledge, once you taste food made with herbs and olive oil instead of deep fried blech, you know, and you might be inspired to try to cook it yourself, that's nothing but a great thing and a powerful thing. And cooking with your family and bringing kids into the mix there, because obviously kids love to cook. And I say this about a lot of shows. You know, there are people, for example, Rachel Ray, there are people that are not big Rachel Ray fans. I completely disagree with them. You may not like some of her yummo language and stuff that's a little bit cute, but Rachel Ray propels millions of Americans into their own kitchens to cook with good recipes made with honest ingredients and talks about the importance of sharing cooking with your family and what that means and knowing what's in your food. It's the only way to know what's in your food is to
anything
make it yourself.
You make at home is going to be ultimately better for your life than anything that you can get outside.
I agree. I truly believe that. I think, and I'm not taking credit for this myself. I mean, listen, we stand on the shoulders of Emeril and Mario and Giada and Ina and Sarah Moulton and before that, the Galloping Gourmet and Jeff Smith and Martha Stewart and all of these people. But this phenomenon, and you know, there was a time when network television would have laughed at the idea of doing food programming, and now they all do it. All of them.
Everybody wants in the food space.
Into the food. Is that what they call it? The food space. Some of them do it better than others. I don't think anybody does it as well as Food Network.
Well, because I think ultimately we always take the food seriously.
Exactly. And we
it's in the name of the network, and so we have to honor that.
I don't have a culinary degree the way you do, and I would love to. I always say this. I wish I had 6 months to go to Italy and study culinary. I just can't seem to find the 6 months.
Got it.
Is the problem. But I do. I have a certain amount of knowledge, and I have what I believe is the same level of devotion and passion for food, and the knowledge is important too. And I think a lot of people jumping into this business may be more about television production than they are about food. You happen to be a double threat. Perhaps a triple, which in that area,
or completely neutered in both. I mean, it depends on how you look at it. But I do think that at Food Network we do things better because the food comes first.
The food comes first. But I gotta say, I will also, when I was judging on Top Chef, which happened before I got more deeply involved with Food Network, I learned a lot from Tom Colicchio in the sense that. Your decisions, and people are, as you know, very suspicious about these food competition shows. They are always, we're all suspicious. The whole ritual of wine service in a fancy restaurant is based entirely on suspicion.
Yes.
That the restaurant
distrust.
Is distrust. When a waiter brings a wine bottle to your table, he shows you the bottle before he opens it, so you can see that it's the brand you asked for. And then in front of you, he removes the foil, pulls out the cork, and then hands it to you. Your job then is not to sniff the cork, but rather to read it to make sure that the brand
name is the actual cork.
That it is a cork that corresponds to the brand that you're paying for, and that they didn't pour a bunch of plonk into a fancy bottle. People are similarly suspicious about these cooking competition shows and whether they're rigged. And Tom Colicchio said to me way back in the day that you must base your decision on who wins entirely on the food. Entirely. You can't. And producers will sometimes kind of imply.
Yes. Yeah, because they're after character.
They're after characters. And that's their job. Story. It's their job. But Tom said the minute you start playing that game, A, you're not honoring the performance of these people. You're being unfair. You're not honoring food. You're not respecting this craft the way you must. Sooner or later, it will bite you in the tail if you try to fake these things. I will say that on Top Chef, on Iron Chef, on Chopped, on any of the food competitions I've been on, I have never seen a whiff of anything inappropriate or wrong. The decisions that I've been involved in were always made by the judges. Even on and even a producer, one of the producers on Top Chef at the time was Andy Cohen, who now has gone on to superstardom at Bravo. And I remember on the top of Aspen Mountain, Andy Cohen telling us to choose the winner we wanted to choose between Hung Nguyen and Dale Levitsky. Hung ultimately won. Dale was much more popular. He was a much warmer, seemingly nicer, funnier guy. Would have been a better winner for Bravo. And Andy told us to make the choice based on the merits, and we did.
There you go. I mean, that's a lot of people. I mean, I agree. People all the time ask me, okay, Iron Chef, come on. Like, near as I can tell, and on all the shows that I've done on Food Network, never has a producer twisted my arm or implied that I should twist the arm of a judge.
I have seen producers come up and say, they might say, you know, the Chopped is a 12-hour shoot day.
Right.
That's a long day.
It's a long slog.
And we do sometimes have contestants that are obnoxious or that are very charming. We've had producers come up to the judges and say, we keep little scorecards. They make little scorecards. Mm-hmm. They're not, we don't reveal that in the show.
No.
It's just something that they do for reference to help them remember.
Most shows do. It helps you remember and helps you rate one over another numerically. Yeah, a lot of us come up with these systems. It keeps you honest.
Yeah, presentation, taste, creativity. You might make a little note like, oh, this dish was too salty or whatever. I have had producers come up to the judges later and say, oh, I can see you're leaning toward having Alton win the show today, but their scorecards tell a little different story, so I just wanted to chat about that. They're not trying to twist arms.
No, but they want to understand and keep you on track.
Yeah.
Although I think deep down they would twist if they could, but they know they can't.
They
know
they can't. Their producers' jobs are to... The thing about Iron Chef or Chopped both is that producers, they are, in a sense, reality shows, a term I don't like very much. They're only reality shows. I think of my show as a game show, basically.
Yours is a game show.
But there is a level of reality involved in that the producers, there are three or four or five people up in the control room taking notes on everything that happens. It's a reality show in the sense that the producers don't know what the stories are going to be until they happen.
Yep.
So if a culinary instructor drops a spatula on the floor, picks it up and then continues to use it, that's going to be a big story on Chopped. And we just have to hope that we got pictures of it.
Yep.
Because that's why we have 10 cameras, and they're really good camera operators. They have to notice if somebody drops a piece of chicken on the floor and then continues to serve it.
Right. It's real-time journalism. It's runtime journalism.
Yeah.
The story is going to unfold, and you have to be there to get it.
Yeah.
It's that, and it's a sporting event. I mean, Iron Chef America is a sporting event.
Absolutely.
It just is. It's an athletic sporting event.
Very. And you look at the camera operators are dripping with sweat by the end of a round.
Sometimes the chefs too.
And often the chefs too. Yeah. I sweated like a pig when I was on Iron Chef. And they did a very kind edit. I think I turned out fine.
You did.
That was fun.
That was fun. It was fun to watch. It was fun to watch. And I thought I was jealous. I don't get to ever be in Kitchen Stadium, so I'm always on the outside of Kitchen Stadium.
Your fans must ask you all the time. They must say, I mean, fans love the idea of turning the tables
and
taking smarty pants judges and hosts and making them cook. And you are you have a degree.
But I won't go. I won't go down there. And I won't go down there for one big reason. I don't ever want to give anybody another shot at my job.
That's what I always say. You know, but the one caveat I have said is that I might cook on Chopped if Alton guests hosts. But I still won't do it because who would it be fair and appropriate for me to cook against? I'm the slowest cook in the world, ironically.
I'm hideously slow. It would have to be like a four-hour thing. No, I couldn't do it.
I don't even like to cook things that cook quickly.
Yeah.
I'm not excited to make an omelet or a stir fry. I want to put a pork shoulder in my smoker for hours and hours and hours and allow that. I like food where the flavor develops.
Transformative. And yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, and a tough hunk of bony meat becomes melt in your mouth.
Because it's magic.
It is magic.
Yeah, time is my favorite ingredient. Whenever anybody asks me, what do you have to have to cook? I say time.
Oh, that's
because I don't want it. And they're all, you're like, T-H? And I'm like, no, T-I-M-E, time. It is an ingredient.
I'm going to steal that from you.
Take it.
Well, and that's partly because, one of the reasons that a lot of Americans don't cook is because they don't have a lot of spare time. To have the luxury of time to be able to cook real food in these slow techniques that are often necessary to make something yummy, that's a luxury not everybody has.
No. But with a little technology, you can do some things.
Technology, a little planning. And, the idea of if you do have time on Sunday, roast a great big turkey, and then you can make sandwiches and soup and quesadillas all week long.
The truth is if you will plan a little bit, and strategize how you're going to use food, you can do a lot. If you've got X amount of hours up front, I think that you can do it.
I think, and I said nice things about children before, so now I'll say something that's less. Kids are the whole darn problem.
Kids. I have one daughter, yeah. Got a 13-year-old.
So if you have a house, my sister has three children, and so that means that her life is chaos. They have all these activities. Even just getting a moment alone, a moment of clarity where you can think about cooking from scratch is hard under mm-hmm. those circumstances. On the other hand, I have another friend, my childhood best friend, whose name happens to also be Ted, who lives in Bellingham, Washington, that he's got two kids, and he and his wife and their children, food is pretty much the epicenter of their life. They live in an older suburb. They've got a decent-sized yard with a fence around it. They have 13 chickens, and the whole yard is a farm. The whole yard. It's crazy. At raised beds, they grow everything from corn.
That's fantastic.
Nancy runs a gluten-free bakery in the basement. Ted just opened a wine shop called Seifert & Jones Wines. And they have managed to have kids and somehow organized their whole lives around food. So the kids have been cooking from the moment they were born. If you make it a priority, it can happen.
You have to make it a priority. Very few people that tell me they don't have time to cook actually don't have time to cook.
Right.
It's because they haven't made time to cook.
And you know what? That's fine. Not everybody has to cook. Listen, I don't. My needle pointing sucks.
Yeah.
I'm a decent shot, but I can't play golf. I mean, when you meet people who say, "Oh, I can't cook," my response is, "But you're a school teacher. Yeah. You're an attorney. You could cook."
Yeah. You don't. Or have chosen not to. And that's okay. It's your life. That's fine. But don't tell me you can't.
Yeah, you're
unless
smart.
Unless you have no hands. Or, I mean, there's something that and even then, if you have a will, you can figure it out. Right. But this is a primary skill. Feeding yourself is a primary tool of self-reliance on planet Earth.
If
you don't have it, you die. Or you're a victim. You know, if you can't feed yourself, you're going to be a victim. And I don't think we want to be victims.
I don't think I'm really even that great of a cook. But I think I love doing it. It's just like my gardening. I don't know why I love to do these things so much.
Well, I love to do things that I'm very mediocre at.
How are you at flying a plane?
I get by.
You're
okay.
You're here
okay.
so far.
I'm not great. I'm not great, but I am. I'm here. I get better. I get better all the time. I do.
When I go through it, when I'm working, when we're shooting, we usually shoot 4 days a week because the day is so long that everybody needs a little extra time to recover.
Yeah, 12-hour days, long time.
I get antsy when I'm not allowed to cook for more than a couple of days. And you can't cook when I get home from Chopped at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, I have to be in bed by 10 because I have to get up super early the next day. There's no time to cook.
I understand.
That's when the freezer comes in handy and all those stews and soups that I made.
That you made on the days that you did have time.
But, I don't know if you feel that way. When you're shooting Iron Chef and you're in this hotel for a month and you're unable to access your grill or, in your case, your flamethrower.
I don't stay here that long. I rent apartments because I can't not have a kitchen.
Oh, good.
I could stay in a hotel room for about a week, but otherwise I need It's oddly enough, I need to do laundry. Mm-hmm. I want to do my own laundry, and I need to cook, even if it is literally boiling an egg. I need to go into a kitchen and prepare food. I'm very lucky at home in that I've got a policy of my daughter every day will have a hot cooked breakfast by me, and I will get up and I make breakfast, and it's actually my favorite meal of the day because I like to cook with my head empty, you know, in pajamas, and you just, you know, you go and do. But I can't do hotels for long periods of time. I must have access to a kitchen, and I am not the world's best cook, but I need to cook.
Me too.
I need the activity of cooking.
I never really quite phrased it that way. I need to cook too.
I need to do it. And there's cooking, there's serving others, and there's eating. I actually prefer cooking and serving others better than eating.
I think I do too.
I value my food more when I'm making it to feed other people. I like feeding people. And I think that most cooks, you know, all the great cooks will tell you I'm feeding people, you know, which is something that we might lose sight of with the whole television thing. And I think there are a lot of kids that do end up in culinary school who don't actually want to feed anybody.
I think you're right.
They want to be rock stars.
And that is an act of enormous, it's profound. You're sustaining people, you're nurturing people, you're also making them laugh, and you're mm-hmm. exciting them, and you're dazzling their palates. But the fact that you're making them continue to live, an act of great generosity, and then an act, of course, that we want some applause for.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
At all. Ted Allen, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alton. Great to be with you.
Hi, I've moved locations. I'm now in my kitchen in Marietta, Georgia. And I'm sorry about the noise in the background because it's like landscaping day in my neighborhood. So behind me, you might hear the sound of multiple lawnmowers and blowers and weed-eating devices at work around the neighborhood. So why am I in my kitchen? Well, yeah, after I was having this chat with Ted Allen, I was thinking about his show Chopped, and I always like to do something on the show, you know, after I talk to a guest that really has something to do with you know, their work. And I was thinking about Chopped, and I was thinking about the essence of Chopped. What makes Chopped tick? What makes it any good to begin with? And I realized it's the weird food combinations, right? It's the fact that these people open these baskets and, oh my God, there's this stuff in there that should never be put together. And I started thinking about, why is that? I mean, why is it that we have, you know, this concept of weird combinations? You know, why is it that we don't, you know, put certain foods together, and what's weird about that? And then I started thinking, well, I wonder if people in general just have some certain weird things that they do with food. So I get on Twitter, and all I did was say, hey, give me a quick idea of a weird food combination that you like. And in 10 minutes, I've got 600 plus tweets, and all I've got to say is, you people are twisted. You people are weird. Granted, about 75% of these combinations are not shocking. And some of them you can even see where the natural, you know, progression would come from. All right, at least 20 of you have tweeted me about, maple syrup on scrambled eggs. Okay. Fatty, salty, sweet, and believe it or not, most of these combinations involve either crunchy, smooth, salty, sweet, tangy, fatty. All right, that one I get. It makes sense, and I also understand how it happens. You know, breakfast, it's easy to get some syrup from pancakes or French toast on some eggs. No big deal. I got that. But some of this is, I'm sorry, chocolate cake and gravy. Okay, number one. Okay, I guess I can see how that would happen. Maybe at a Thanksgiving somewhere, you know, somebody decided to have the chocolate, you know, cake on the plate that had the gravy on it, and they decided they liked it, you know, but that's some sweet, and that's some, you know, I'll go there. But some of these, you know, get a lot weirder, and I mean, sour gummy candies and beer. Okay, that just comes out of being up really late at night and probably doing something illegal. Justin Warner, my friend Justin Warner said a frog and Dr. Pepper. Anyway, Thanks, Justin, and I'm sure you really mean it. Anyway, so many of these were weird that I decided I had to just come down to the kitchen and line up what I could of these suggestions and try them, because I'm a bold guy, right? And I'm going to do this. So you're going to hear a lot of noise as I try to move around the kitchen with my microphone. Now, I realized that when I was a kid, one of the things that I really liked – oh, sorry, it's my drawer – was cold canned green beans and ketchup. I don't know where I got it. And I'm sure I didn't invent it. And I noticed that several of you actually sent that in to me, that that was something that that you liked. Buttermilk poured over cornbread. Everybody does that. Potato chips, peanuts, avocado, and rice and chicken. Oh, that's all right. That's a little bit odd. Nutella and birthday cake. No, everybody likes that. Scrambled egg and green beans. That's a little odder, I guess. Maple syrup and cottage cheese. You know, a lot of you guys are fixated on mayonnaise, peanut butter, and syrups. You're also apparently obsessed with jelly. We'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, I'm going to go back to when I was a kid, and I'm going to crack open and try canned green beans with ketchup. So I'm just going to open. I actually do have a can of green beans, and I'm not going to say what brand, Omani. they don't pay me to say that. They don't even send me free green beans. All right, so here's my green beans, and I'm going to dump those out. Hold on, I get a plate. I'm going to dump some of these out on the plate. Okay, that's nice. Got about 12 beans here, and I'm almost out of ketchup. And this is a Heinz household. No, they don't pay me to say that. They could, couldn't they? Oh, heck, I'm almost out. All right, well, I got to get more of that. All right, so let's see if the romance is still there. And again, I'm sorry about the bad audio if you're just joining us. I'm in my kitchen tasting these weird food combos, and I'm going to try some of yours momentarily. My Twitter literally runneth over. I'm up now to over 1,000 tweets about strange food combos. This, of course, comes out of our conversation with Ted Allen from Chopped, because Chopped is really about strange food combinations. All right, here go the beans. I should clear my palate with a little water. Excuse me. Hold on. Okay, I have some water. Ah, my palate is now cleansed. Here we go. Well, it takes me back very much to my childhood. But I don't really like it. And I think that the reason why is because I've learned in the time since I was a little kid that green beans have a lot more to offer than this. Also, these weren't chilled, and maybe that makes a difference. They came right out of the pantry. You know, what this makes me want now is like a nice green bean casserole that's actually, or green beans that are baked in a tomato sauce casserole. So when I was a kid, I can see why I like this. I got salty, I got tangy, I got sweet, I've got crunch from the bean and this kind of vegetal thing going on. So it's still kind of a basic taste, texture thing. It's just that I've grown up, and now this just leaves me feeling sad. All right, I'm putting that away. All right, now I'm gonna try one from you. At least five of you on Twitter said that you like cheddar cheese, and I have here a block of. I'm sorry if it's noisy. I'm not a really good audio engineer. You just have to work it out. This is some Wisconsin sharp cheddar cheese, and it's got kind of a black wax on it. And I'm gonna cut myself a cube of this. Actually, yeah, it's about a 1x1x 1/4-inch slice. I don't want to be piggish about this. Okay. And what some of you have said is. Matter of fact, at least five of you have said that you like this combined with grape jelly. All right, so here I am. This is not a flavor combination I've ever had before, but I'm looking at it, and I don't even know how this would, you know, happen in the natural world, except for some desperate mother trying to put a sandwich together, and you know, the kid likes cheese, the kid likes jam or jelly, so they're going to like this. So I'm looking at it, and what I'm expecting is, okay, I know that I've got fatty, salty from... and dairy, of course, from the cheese. And I've got tangy, and I got sweet, and fruity from the jelly. So I'm gonna put this in my mouth now, and this is new territory for me, Twitter folks. So here I go. And this is not gonna turn into some show where you just send me weird combinations and I eat them. Okay, I want to be real straightforward with that. All right, Ted Allen, this is for you. This is
chop today in my kitchen. So here it goes, sharp cheddar cheese with grape jelly. This is not a big jump, right?
That's really good.
Yeah, that's like really good. Now, of course, I've had,
I got a mouthful of cheese.
You know, I've put fruit preserves on brie and baked it before, so this is not a shocker, but just a cold lump of cheddar cheese with grape jelly on it is kind of the same thing. It's got those primal taste flavor elements. You certainly respond to when we're kids.
I'm sorry, that piece of cheese was probably a little bigger than I should have had.
Mm. All right, I'm going to rinse that down. So I started kind of wimpy, didn't I? I should go on to something that's a little more challenging. I'm looking down to here. You know, salt, vinegar, potato chips, and Nutella. I'm out of Nutella. I love Nutella, but I don't have any today. Beans and ketchup, we tried that. That's a little bit disappointing now. I don't really like that very much anymore. Okay. Tilapia and peanut butter. Dude, I'm not even going to call you out by name because you frighten me. Granted, tilapia needs all the help it can possibly. Oh, wow, got another 500 tweets. People got to slow down on me, all right? Hot sauce and ice cream, cinnamon and red pepper omelet, pickles on cinnamon rolls. I liked it when I was pregnant. I bet you did. That's kind of classic. But then again, it makes sense. Some of these aren't really terribly frightening. A lot of you folks think that it's just, you know, if you put, you know, potato chips on it, it's weird. Well, that's not really true. Okay, that's pretty twisted. Sauerkraut and chocolate. Peppermints and cheddar cheese. Oh, hold on. Let's go. I'm actually going to take the computer and my little microphone into my pantry. Okay, so I'm going in the pantry. I'm going to put the computer up here on the refrigerator. Hold on. There we go. I think my daughter has some peppermints. My daughter loved peppermints. She had some left over from Christmas time. Hold on. What is this? Oh, that's peppermint bark. That's not the same thing. Peppermints. Hold on. I'm sure I've got some peppermints up here someplace. She's nutty about peppermints. Hold on. Is that what that said? Ooh, cottage cheese. No, I'm not going to eat that. Hold on, peppermint cheddar cheese. All right, hold on. I'm sure I can do this. Just stay with me, folks. Talk amongst yourselves for a minute. Hold on, up here. Oh, there. Okay, all right, here we go. All right, so I've got a peppermint here, and it's just a peppermint hard candy, and I'm going to try that with cheddar cheese as well since I've got the cheese out, and see if you guys are right about that. All right, here's my peppermint. All right, so I know, you didn't give me instructions. Am I supposed to crunch up the peppermint or suck on it while I'm eating the cheddar cheese? I don't know. So I'm going to eat a smaller piece of cheddar cheese this time so you don't have to hear me muttering. And I guess I'll chew this peppermint up first. Hold on. Okay. What? No. It's all crunched up my mouth. Now here comes the cheese. No, that's not good. I'm not going to spit it out. I'm going to swallow it, but that's bad. Don't eat that. Yeah. Ugh. All right. Okay, that was disgusting. I must cleanse my palate again. Again, we're doing this because Ted Allen was on the show, Chopped, weird food combinations. I go online, I go to Twitter, I say, give me some weird things, and and you guys have just basically poured my Twitter account over with this bizarre stuff. Jägermeister and double mint bubblegum. I don't want to even know how you came up with that. I've had a lot for Doritos and peanut butter. Apparently, you guys have put Doritos on a lot of things, especially you people who seem to be gaming enthusiasts, apparently do that a great deal. Let's see. Okay, I don't have any cinnamon rolls, so I can't try the pickle and cinnamon roll. You know, banana and mayo, a lot of you guys listed that. I don't think that's that strange. Popcorn and milk, not that strange because that was originally what popcorn, one of the original cereals in this country was popcorn. Fish sticks and custard. Yeah, nice try. I know that works. Rice and mayo. Tuna, avocado, and strawberries.
All right. Well, I can see that. But here's one that at least 10 of you. Oh, I like this one from Arkansas. My mom in Arkansas likes Oreos and margarine. As if there wasn't enough fat shoved in the middle of that Oreo, which I think is pretty much like vegetable shortening and vanilla flavoring. I don't have any Oreos, so I can't try that one. But here's one I can try. Several of you listed peanut butter and sriracha. Sriracha hot sauce, of course, which is, here in America, we get that from Hui Fong Foods, Rosemond, California. And sriracha, of course, if you're a Food Network star, if you like Aren't Chef America, you see this stuff all the time. It's a chili sauce. And I'm reading from the back here. Sriracha, made from sun-ripened chilies, is ready to use in soup sauces, blah, blah, blah. Yakety-yak. It's basically just a chili sauce. It's actually made in the USA, even though most people think that it comes from, like, Thailand or... I don't know where it's supposed to come from. Where it's supposed to... I don't know. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I always thought it was either Vietnamese or Thai, but I guess I was wrong. So here's the part that I haven't done, and I'm a little frightened by this one. I am taking a nice big spoonful of peanut butter. Now, this is peanut butter that I admit I grind in the big grind machine at Whole Foods. No, they don't pay me to say that, but they could if they wanted to. And I am going to have sriracha. It was supposed to be on a peanut butter sandwich. Several of you mentioned that. I don't trust that. Well, I do, but I don't. I'm just not going to waste a whole piece of bread. So what I've done is I've squirted a big dollop of sriracha onto my peanut butter. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking, okay, I know that I've got some sweet in the peanut butter, and I've got fat, I've got salty, and I've got hot in the sauce. So it makes sense to me as I'm looking at it. But still, I'm not looking forward to it. All right, here goes. Obviously, this is going to take me a while to eat. Just talk amongst yourselves. Well, of course, this shouldn't surprise me, right? It's hot sesame. It's sesame noodles. You know, if you've had cold sesame noodles in the peanut butter and hot sauce, of course, that's all this really is. It's good. I shouldn't have been surprised. I'm not surprised. I should have been, though. Looking more at you guys' list, I'm sorry. Salsa and cottage cheese is not that strange. I mean, some of you are sick, but most of you are pretty normal, I think. Fritos and peanut butter. You know what I like? Fritos corn chips dipped in that cheap caramel sauce they sell in the produce department to dip apples in. I think that's pretty good. All right, I got to wrap things up. So the last one that I'm going to try, and really, I don't even know why I was thought that was going to be odd, because it's basically just a sesame noodle. I guess it's just one of those things that when I saw it on the computer, it seemed a little bit odd. You guys, by the way, do some very strange things with ranch dressing, several of which I'm not going to repeat. I'm not going to repeat that, and I'm not going to repeat that. I wrote some of these down. Pork cracklings on ice cream. That's fantastic. Just imagine, you got the sweet, you got the cold, you got the salty, you got the crunchy with a little fatty. That's great. Egg noodles with cottage cheese and ketchup. Cottage cheese with ramen noodles uncooked. Okay, hold on. I've got ramen noodles. Stay there.
I got ramen noodles. I got them right here. All right, I'm getting a bowl. Hold on. Okay.
This person says to crunch up some ramen noodles. All right, I'm on it. And again, this is all because of Ted Allen. I'm doing this for you, buddy. Some ramen noodles, crunch them up, and add cottage cheese. Well, I happen to be a big cottage cheese fan, so I've got that standing by. Here we go.
Had to open a new package. Well, I'm going to get another spoon, because this one's covered with peanut butter and sriracha.
All right. Now, what's the other thing that you wanted me to add to that? Oh, ketchup. Well, I just used all the ketchup on the... Hold on.
All right, I've got a little more ketchup.
So a little bit of ketchup, ramen noodle. Oh, and the seasoning envelope. All right, hold on. Here we go. All right, there. So there's the seasoning, the crunchy ramen noodle, and cottage cheese. This seems to be the act, desperate act of a... Oh, my microphone's drunk. This seems to be the desperate act of a college student. Hold on. Not bad. I mean, so far we're doing pretty good here. But none of this has been really outrageous. Here again, we've got crunchy,
salty, fatty. Makes perfect sense. It's not. It's not nearly as weird as peppermint sticks and what did I have the peppermint and cheese? Yeah. All right. Here's finally one that frightens me fairly badly, and I actually do have things here to try this. Oreos and guacamole? Really? That is interesting. Altoids and ouzo. All right, I'm out of ouzo. I don't have any. Turkey jam with strawberries and cornflake sandwich. That's not that strange. Pork and beans and tuna. Oh, that's interesting. Chili and Oreos. Apparently Oreos is the leading... No, because there's cheese now. Grated cheese with chocolate chip cookies. So that's pretty strange. Orange juice mixed with milk. Nah, I believe that. That's nothing that... Ooh. Mayonnaise and peaches. Oh, I don't know. I mean, I can buy mayonnaise and pear. Can I... All right, hold on. All right, here's a peach. Here's the mayo. All right, I'm cutting a piece of peach, and it's a beautiful... This is a South Carolina peach, and it's pretty delicious. Oh, gosh, I don't feel good about this. All right, here we go. I gotta get something to get it out with. Hold on. Right here. I'll just use the... Use a spoon from the sour cream. I'm double dipping in my own food. Hold on. All right. I don't want to do this. This is one of my favorite fruits. I'm putting mayonnaise on the peach. Ugh. All right, here goes. No, I won't ever be doing that again. I've definitely learned today that there are some things that I don't need to do, and putting mayonnaise on peach is one of them. I can understand it. I see where it came from, but I'm not ever going to do that again. Looking over some of the new ones that just came in, what do I got here? Peanut butter, cottage cheese. Oh, I've got those things here. A lot of you think that your weirder combinations involve cottage cheese, mayonnaise, peanut butter, jelly, and cheese. And I think that that's because these are things that kids easily get their hands on. And kids are so much more playful with their food. So I think what happens is that kids will tinker around with this stuff, and then you remember it, and it sticks with you later. Banana and spicy tuna sushi. French fries and mayo, that's not weird. Celery sticks with salsa, that's not weird. Pickled ginger and cherries, different. Oxtail, peanut butter, shrimp. Well, that's curry, curry. I know what that is. That's an actual dish. Milkshake and hamburger, we've all done that. Cheddar cheese and ding-dongs. Apparently, people will put cheddar cheese with almost anything. Okay, I was hoping to end with something really, really strange. But in the end, I realized that most of these things that people like, that they think are weird combos, actually make sense when you think about them. Even beer and ice cream. Although beer and the sour gummies, I'm going to have to try that a little bit later. But, you know, it's those basic combinations. Salty, sweet, bitter, tangy, fatty. You know, it's not that strange to put, bacon on, crispy bacon on a veggie burger. That's not a strange combo. That's just not what you're supposed to do. I'm trying to look for one that I think is really, really twisted before I end. Okay, and here it is. Here's my closer. This person fills a turkey baster with fish sauce and squirts it into Hostess Twinkies. I suspect you're making that up. I'm not going to call you out, but if you are really doing that, then I am certainly going to nominate you for an episode of Chopped. And I think that's going to end my kitchen testing segment for today. I got a lot to clean up.
Well, food fans, that's all we've got for you today. I want to thank our callers and everybody that sent us questions to askalton at altonbrown.com. And I especially want to thank Mr. Ted Allen for taking the time to sit down with us and let us look deep into his mind and soul. The Alton Brown cast will be back soon with another edition or episode or whatever you want to call it. And until that time, America, cook smart.